The young woman is last seen sitting on her couch in her lovely cottage on 70 acres. Soon after, the couch cushions are missing, and so is she. A 10-year-old girl tells of plans to go shopping with her uncle. She disappears from school with a man that cannot possibly be related to her. A man disappears without a trace after asking a neighbor to take care of his dog for 3 days. A young man is abducted by 3 men at an intersection. 14 years later, the case still isn't resolved. Welcome back to Never to Be Seen Again. Hey everyone, and welcome back for yet another episode of Mysterious Disappearances. You are listening to Never to Be Seen Again, the podcast, and I am your host, Laura. So, this week we are at episode 29. Last week was a little rough, and I'm sorry everyone who listened to episode 28 in Delaware. This week is going to be a little bit better. And also, if you haven't listened to the bonus episode, that has a whole bunch of states in it, I suggest you do that. It's a little hard to follow because it just jumps all over the place, but it's a pretty good episode with some really good cases in it. Anyway, this week we are going to Connecticut, and I'm only going to be covering 4 cases this week, but it's 4 pretty good cases. So let's just talk about the stats real quick. Population as of 2019 is reported as 3.565 million, 51.2% females, and 48.8% males. The DOE Network has 39 total listed cases for Connecticut. That's 24 females and 15 males. Namus has 212 listed cases with 118 males and 94 females. And the Trolley Project has 75 total cases with 34 male cases and 41 female cases. So, as I mentioned, I only have 4 cases this week. 2 are female and 2 are male. I only have 1 juvenile case, and I did read quickly through a whole lot of juvenile cases in Connecticut. But I opted not to cover a whole lot of them. Connecticut was a really weird state for me to do research on missing cases. I had a good amount. 75 cases listed on the Trolley Project alone gave me a pretty good range to pull from, but the information that was provided on those cases was just not the kind of information or the amount of information that I would need to tell you. So, in any case, we are only going to be talking about the 4 cases, the 1 juvenile case, and as usual, all of the cases that I'm going to cover this week are on the Trolley Project, so if you want to go read up on the case there, you can do that, but I'm going to be telling you pretty much what is on the Trolley Project profile for each missing individual. So, are y'all ready? Oh, you need a minute? Well, press the pause button. Okay, let's go. Okay, so we're going to start in 1982 this week with the disappearance of Julianne Miller. She is case number MP2561 in Namus and case number 568 DFCT in the DOE Network. Julianne is a Caucasian female with blonde hair and possibly blue eyes. She was born on July 18th of 1955. She was 27 at the time of her disappearance, and she would be 65 now. She stood at 5'6" and weighed 110 pounds. And she is listed as missing from Old Saybrook, Connecticut. Okay, so Julianne was a graduate student at the University of Hartford and worked part-time at a daycare center in 1982. At the time, she was living with her boyfriend, whose name is James Clayton, and they lived together in a cottage on Clinton Avenue in Saybrook, Connecticut. The couple, they had been together since 1981, and they shared a passion for karate. Now, Clayton, James Clayton, the boyfriend, and I'm just going to refer to him as Clayton from now on, just because it's easier. So Clayton had a black belt in karate, and by all accounts, Clayton is described as a good-looking and articulate guy. People just said he was just really a cool guy. So there are some discrepancies in the dates and the years of this next part, but none of that really matters because you'll get the gist of it. So Julianne's father transferred ownership of that cottage that they lived in to Julianne sometime in 1981. That is what the Charlie Project has it listed as. Somewhere else I read that it was 1977 that he transferred it to her, but that doesn't really matter a whole bunch. So he transfers ownership of this cottage to Julianne. But then I think it was sometime in 1982, it might even have been late 1981, Julianne added Clayton's name to half of the property. Now, I want to make it clear that they were not married. They were just together. They had been together since 1981. So I don't know why there was this need for Julianne to add Clayton to the property's ownership or whatever. But we do know that Julianne picked up a quit claim deed on September 20th of 1982 in hopes of having Clayton sign away his portion of the property rights. See, because apparently she no longer wanted him to own or be able to claim any of that property. Now, let me tell you, well, it'll come up later about how far this property stretches, but what's not going to come up later is the fact that this property actually stretches 70 acres. So this is a pretty large property with this cottage on it. This cottage also, she also, I'm sorry, this cottage was also shared by two other tenants. So they had like, they rented a portion of this cottage out, apparently. So the last day that Julianne was last seen was on September 21st of 1982, and it was about 10 p.m. When she was last seen inside the living room of the cottage. And one of the two tenants that was also living in the house said that Julianne and Clayton had reported had been sitting on the living room couch watching TV at about 10 p.m. So now this tenant said that there was like tension in the air. He or she, I'm not sure. I believe it was a he though. He could tell that they had been arguing, or if something was wrong between the two of them. He said because when he just passed through the area, he can feel the intensity between the pair. So after this 10 p.m. sighting on September 21st of 1982, Julianne is never seen by anyone ever again. So, what we do end up finding out via one of these tenants is that, and they tell the police this, that the furniture in Julianne's cottage had been rearranged after she was last seen, like shortly after. Some of the couch cushions were missing, and Clayton simply told these tenants or this witness that he had sent the cushions out to the dry cleaners to be cleaned. Now, the official date listed as Julianne's disappearance is the following day, so September 22nd. But Clayton is not the one that reported Julianne missing. Julianne's father returned home from vacation on September 29th and found out that Julianne was nowhere to be found, and he called the police. So when police get this missing person report, they of course go and question Clayton. And Clayton says that he didn't want to cause an issue or any trouble for Julianne by reporting her missing, and that's why he didn't. He stated that her father had requested that she remain at the cottage while he was on vacation, so that she could keep an eye on things for him. And I don't really, even if he did say that, I don't really think that meant that she couldn't go anywhere for, a period of time. But that's the argument that Clayton is providing to police. So Clayton claimed that he last saw Julianne enter a brown pickup truck driven by an African American male on September 22nd of 1982, which was the day after she was last seen sitting on the couch with Clayton. Now, what's odd about this claim by Clayton is that Clayton is an African American male and he owned an identical brown pickup truck that he described to the police. So of course the investigators are like, this is just not right. Or this is just odd to them, which I understand. Now, Julianne didn't take a whole lot with her either. She left behind her car. She left behind her golden retriever, whose name was, I want to say Bojo. And she left behind her purse inside the cottage. Now, when the investigators go into the cottage to, do their business, they find that quit claim deed for the cottage and the property inside of Julianne's purse, but Clayton had not signed it. Now, many people believe that the couple actually had an argument over the property on the night that Julianne was last seen, and this is kind of why there was that tension in the room when the tenant saw him. Now, there is this claim, and I don't know how true it is, but I have seen it mentioned in this case. There's a claim that Clayton reportedly began calling Julianne's parents late at night for months after she disappeared. Now, Julianne's dad never mentioned what was discussed during those conversations, but apparently, whatever it was, or why ever Clayton was calling, seemed to cause the family to be completely frightened by Clayton. Now, of course, as you would suspect, Clayton requested that the two tenants that were also living in the cottage move out. And this was shortly after Julianne disappeared, within a few weeks after her disappearance, he asked them to move out. And I mean, you have to think about this. This is not necessarily damning to Clayton, because if these tenants are pointing a finger of suspicion at him, he definitely doesn't want them around. But I don't know how to feel about it. But I mean, Julianne's missing, maybe he just doesn't want anyone else on the property, or whatever. But what ends up happening is that these tenants, who were these witnesses to that last saw Julianne and saw the situation inside the house around the time, they take polygraph tests at police request. They do it willingly, and they discover that, or these polygraph tests prove that they weren't lying about what was going on. They didn't tell any fabricated stories about, how the tension was in the air, or when they last saw her, or what they last saw, or that the furniture was moved. The other issue, and the thing that, of course, makes Clayton look a little bit guilty, is that he refused to take a lie detector test. Now, I will say this, if I know that lie detector tests can be wrong sometimes. So maybe this was just a strategic move on Clayton's part, and he didn't want to be looked at a certain way if he didn't pass or, whatever. So let's move on to something else that's a little more damning. So police actually discovered blood on the cushions and springs on the living room couch in that old Saybrook cottage. But of course, back in 1982, DNA testing was not available. Investigators were unable to determine if the blood actually matched Miller's type at the time. I don't know if that technology was in place. I gotta imagine that it was, but I don't know why they weren't able to prove that. So Clayton actually said that this blood was from a dog. Portions of the living room carpet had white spots on them as well, which, if you know anything about true crime or you have watched true crime documentaries or whatever, those white spots on the carpet would indicate that, somebody tried to clean up some stains with bleach, and of course your brain automatically goes to, well, it's blood stains. But of course, this can't be proven, especially back in this time, back in 1982 when DNA testing was just not where it is now. So Julianne's family also reported that her grandmother's wedding ring was missing, along with several other pieces of, high quality jewelry. That ring was actually recovered later at a pawn shop in New Haven, Connecticut. This was months after Julianne disappeared. Clayton's brother had actually sold the items to the pawn store, and that's how they ended up there. Now, of course, you want to make a connection that Clayton's brother got the ring from Clayton, and because Clayton didn't want to be looked at as guilty, he just had his brother go sell it for him. So by the end of 1982, authorities are not hesitating to announce that Clayton is the prime suspect in Julianne's disappearance. But he has never been charged in connection with this case. They believe their theory is that he murdered Julianne at the cottage, then buried her body somewhere on the property. I mean, 70 acres. And that 70-acre property extends near the Deep River and borders the Cockaponsett State Forest in Connecticut. So we're talking about 70 acres from, a river to national or state forests. So now time passes and this is cold. Even though Clayton is prime suspect, they don't really have anything else to go on. But then something happens in May of 2002. This is when Clayton was convicted in military court of attempted murder and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Now, what happened here? So, Clayton was a captain in the Army Medical Corps and was stationed in Schofield Barracks in Honolulu, Hawaii, around in November of 2001. Prosecutors say that Clayton fractured a military officer's skull with a hammer during a robbery attempt. Now, Clayton's claim is that he blacked out and he simply could not remember this incident occurring. He, of course, went to prison and was incarcerated. I think he's out now, but he was incarcerated in, I'm sorry, y'all, in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. So after his conviction, investigators again had this refreshed, energy into Julianne's case, and they began re-interviewing witnesses and began retesting blood on the couch for DNA. But I am sad to tell you that there have been no current or new developments in this case as in regards to like DNA testing or arrests or, any other potential suspects being named. And of course, Julianne still hasn't been located. I am curious about what happened to the property because if Clayton didn't sign that quit claim deed, he would be the owner of the property. So I don't know if he sold it or if he still owns it. And I have to think that if he still owns it, the only way the police can get onto that property, maybe search for Julianne, is by getting a warrant. And I don't know if they have enough to get a warrant, and that might be part of the issue. So, if you know anything about the disappearance of Julianne Miller, you can contact the Old Saybrook Police Department or the Connecticut State Police and provide them with your information. And hopefully, Julianne's case can be resolved sometime in the near future, hopefully. So, our next case this week is our only juvenile case this week, and it is the disappearance of Bianca Elaine LeBron. She is case number MP4033 in Namus, and her NCMEC number is 923729. Bianca is a Hispanic female with brown hair and hazel eyes. She was born on June 26th of 1991, and she was 10 at the time of her disappearance. She would be 29 now. At the time, she stood at 4'11" and weighed 115 pounds. She was last seen wearing a green, beige, and brown camouflage shirt, beige pants, black boots, and a dark blue denim jacket. Bianca has a birthmark on her forehead. So Bianca was last seen on November 7th of 2001 in Bridgeport, Connecticut. So in 2001, Bianca was a fifth grade student at Elias Howe School in her hometown of Bridgeport. On November 7th of 2001, she arrived to school to attend classes in the early morning hours as usual. And after she got to school, she told her friends and a teacher that her uncle would be taking her shopping during the day. She even invited some of her friends to go along, but they, of course, declined. Witnesses, which included, most of her classmates or some of her classmates, would tell authorities that Bianca got into a vehicle at about 8:30 that morning before classes even began. They described the vehicle as an older model, two-tone brown and tan van with tinted windows. The exterior was in pretty poor condition, and it appeared to have been sanded in several areas. Bianca was never heard from again after getting into this vehicle. They described the driver as a Hispanic male, between 20 and 30 years old. Witnesses said he stood about 5'8" to 5'11" with an average build, and the individual had black curly hair styled in a short afro with long sideburns and a beard, brown eyes, and a prominent nose and scratches on both of his cheeks. He was wearing a long-sleeved blue pullover shirt with Gap printed on the front and along the right sleeve. He also had on FUBU jeans with Fat Albert on the right rear pocket and scuffed brown Timberland boots. The man made no attempts to conceal his face from anyone when he picked up Bianca. So Bianca's classmates, of course, believed that this man that picked her up in this van was her uncle, so they didn't think anything of it, and certainly they didn't interfere when Bianca got into the van. But Bianca's family told authorities that Bianca does not, in fact, have an uncle. However, none of her relatives owned a van similar to the vehicle that was involved in her abduction. So, of course, the school received a lot of criticism for their handling of Bianca and her disappearance. You see, administrators did not even realize Bianca was missing until the day after her abduction. Her teachers even counted her absent on the day that she went missing. Stronger security measures and new attendance policies were put into place after Bianca disappeared, but of course, this was too late. And the teacher who had heard Bianca's statement about her plans to go shopping on the day of her abduction, well, that teacher was suspended with pay. Bianca's mother believes, of course, that Bianca is alive, but she had to have her declared legally dead so that she could bring a wrongful death suit against the school. So, at the time of Bianca's disappearance, she lived with her mother and stepfather. Her mom's name is Carmelita Torres, and her stepfather's name is Angelo Garcia, and they lived in Bridgeport. Now, Bianca's family noticed that she was missing at approximately 4:30 p.m. on November 7th, but they weren't too concerned about her not being home because she would oftentimes go to her friend's house after school, and this wasn't an issue. But they didn't call to check, and they didn't really become really, really concerned until Bianca still wasn't home at about 8:30 p.m. That's when her mom called the police. See, she often went to the home of relatives or other parents or other, classmates' homes after school, and she had even once disappeared overnight, but it ended up that she was at a friend's house spending the night and her parents didn't know. Bianca's mom and father were no longer together, of course, but the relationship between the mom and the father were pretty amicable, and neither the mom or the father or the stepfather is suspected of any involvement in her case. Now, Bianca is described as in 2001 as having an outgoing personality with really high self-esteem. She was a good student, and it was uncharacteristic of her to skip school as she did on the day of her disappearance. Her hobbies at the time included dancing and singing to all types of music, as well as shopping at the Milford Mall and Trumbull Mall near the family's house. She also had a pet hamster named Nina at the time. Elias House School has since been closed, and Bianca's father currently or moved to Florida. I'm not sure if he still lives there. But her grandmother still lives in the same house as Bianca was living in 2001. And Bianca's family hopes that she, of course, is found safe and alive. So nothing really comes of this case, but I did find something that I found kind of interesting. Throughout this Charlie Project profile, I didn't see any mention of suspects or anything like that, but I did come across a Reddit thread where this person features missing people in Connecticut, and they did feature Bianca's case, and she wrote a really good article about it. And in this article, it mentions a suspect. So I'm going to tell you about that, although I didn't find anything else to support this. So I will just say before I tell you this information that this is unconfirmed. This is an unconfirmed possible suspect. And so take it with a grain of salt, as I always suggest that you do on these Reddit threads. So it says in late April of 2002, police announced that they wanted to question a man, a 20-year-old man, by the name of Jason Gonzalez. Jason's original last name was Lara, Lara. And at first, the investigators stressed that he was not considered a suspect in this case. They simply stated that he was an acquaintance of Bianca and that he may have some information that could help them find her. So Jason resembled actually the sketch of the Hispanic man that was in the van that picked Bianca up. His friend, and this Jason actually had a friend who owned a van that was similar to the one that Bianca got into on November 7th. He lived in Bridgeport at the time that Bianca, this Jason guy lived in Bridgeport also at the time of Bianca's disappearance. He left that city about a month after she went missing, though. Bianca's great uncle was dating Jason's mother, and this is where the connection comes in. So Bianca met Jason due to this, connection of Bianca's great uncle and Jason's mom. So Bianca's loved one stated that Jason was Bianca's quote unquote secret boyfriend. Her friend stated she had a crush on an older boy. Now, it doesn't say that Jason was this older boy, but the man Jason was this okay, I'm sorry. Let me try again. Jason saw Bianca actually pretty frequently, and allegedly they had been seen kissing at least once. So this accusation, of course, led to a feud between the two families. Jason's fiance would say that the allegations were false, and they had been together for 3 years at the time. And the fiance claims that she saw the girl in passing a couple of times during the summer before her disappearance. She stated that she was with Jason when he was with the young girl, of course, meaning Bianca. And that Bianca and Jason were never alone together. The fiance and Jason had a son together also, so I don't know how that means that he didn't have an interest in Bianca, but it's mentioned. So by October of 2003, police still had not questioned Jason about this case, but by that point, he had gone to jail for drug charges. In November of 2003, Jason called the Bridgeport police and denied any knowledge or involvement in Bianca's case. The police traced this call to Fort Myers, Florida, but when they went to the address, they could not locate him and they realized that he had moved. They obtained a photo of him and learned that he was using the last name Gonzalez instead of Lara. During their search, they found out that he was dating a 53-year-old woman who told them that if anything ever happened to her, Jason did it, and that she felt he was capable of violence. She said she overheard Jason talking to a mutual friend and saying he wanted a younger girlfriend. Jason was eventually found and arrested for an unrelated charge of second-degree forgery, because he used the name Gonzalez while turning in a fingerprint card instead of using his actual last name, Lara. The police persuaded, of course, pushed these charges through because they hoped that they could transfer Jason to Bridgeport and question him after he was arrested on those charges. Jason was eventually questioned intensely about Bianca's disappearance, but he was not very cooperative. A police spokeswoman said that they were trying to get him to come around. His lawyer, of course, the goal there was to clear Jason of any suspicion in Bianca's case whatsoever. And it is discovered that Jason had an alibi for the time of Bianca's disappearance, so he was cleared of the crime. He did plead guilty to a charge of interfering with a police officer and received a suspended sentence in December of 2003. And I don't know if this is that charge is related to Bianca's case at all. So after Jason was released for that crime, he told the newspaper, the Connecticut Post, that he did not know anything about Bianca's disappearance. His mother, of course, told the newspaper the same thing. Jason was arrested again in July of 2011 on unrelated burglary charges. You see, Jason has a long criminal history and has been convicted for several crimes, even before Bianca went missing. He was sentenced to 7 years in 1998 for carjacking two elderly women who resided in Fairfield, Connecticut, a town that's just about 10 minutes away from Bridgeport. He was released from prison early, and he was out by November of 2001 when Bianca, of course, went missing. So police eventually ended up receiving a tip that Bianca was buried in Seaside Park in Bridgeport. The park is 2.5 miles long and in a crescent shape. It borders Bridgeport Harbor, Long Island Sound, and Black Rock Harbor. And in July of 2009, state and local police dug up large holes in the ground on one side of the park, which faced Seabright Avenue and faced the shoreline. They did this as volunteers began setting up, gathering up the Vibes, which is a music festival that featured hippie type music. So I don't believe that there was actually anything found in during that dig, but of course I can't confirm that. So to this day, Bianca's case remains unsolved. She has not been located. The individual that she was last seen with has never been identified. The van has never been located or identified. This happened in 2001. So we're knocking on 20 years here. So hopefully, something will help push this case ahead. And I hope that Bianca is still alive and beautiful and happy at the age of 29, even though obviously she was taken away from her family. So if you know anything about the disappearance of Bianca Elaine LeBron, or the man she was last seen with, or the van she was last seen in, you can contact the Bridgeport Police Department and provide them with any information that you may have, and hopefully Bianca's case can be solved before it becomes 20 years old. Okay, for the next case, we're going to move into the gentleman as we talk about case number MP43 in Namus and case number 5262 DMCT in the Doe Network, the disappearance of William Paul Smolenski Jr. So, Bill, or Billy as he is known, is a Caucasian male with light brown hair and blue eyes. He was born on January 14th of 1973, and he was 31 at the time of his disappearance. He would be 47 now. He stood between 5'11" and 6 foot tall and weighed about 200 pounds. He was last seen wearing a small diamond earring, a gold chain rope style necklace with a cross pendant, and possibly blue jeans, a blue denim shirt, and work boots. Billy is bow-legged and his left ear is pierced. He has a tattoo of a blue cross outline in orange on his left shoulder and a tattoo of a cross with the name Pruitt inside on his right forearm. Billy's hair was in a crew cut at the time of his disappearance, and he wears a size 10 and a half shoe, size 36, 32 pant, and a size large or extra large shirt. Billy is allergic to shellfish, but other than that, he had no other medical conditions, and by all accounts, he was in good physical and mental health at the time of his disappearance. So, Billy was last seen at his residence in the vicinity of the 100 block of Holly Street in Waterbury, Connecticut, between 3:30 and 3:45 p.m. on August 24th of 2004. He went to a neighbor's residence and asked her to take care of his German Shepherd as he was leaving for 3 days to see about a car. He was supposed to go back to the house to give her keys so that she could go inside of his house and feed the animals, but he never did that. Billy was never seen again. All of his personal belongings, including his white 97, 1990, I'm sorry, 1970s or early 1980s model Ford pickup truck were left behind. His wallet and his keys were inside of the truck. So Billy had no history of drug use and no police record, and he only drank on social occasions at the time of his disappearance. He also had several jobs at the time of his disappearance. He worked for Midland Heating and Air Conditioning full time as an apprentice technician. He also had a part-time job driving a tow truck with durable towing, and he also mowed lawns and plowed driveways for some additional side income. He was considered a dependable worker and had just been offered extra hours at one of his jobs after he was laid off from another. So he was a pretty dependable and accountable guy, by all accounts. Billy had deposited most of his last paycheck in his bank account prior to his disappearance, and that bank account has not been accessed since then. At the time of his disappearance, he was preparing his house to be painted, but after he vanished, his parents sold the house, and Billy's social security number has never been used after he disappeared. So here's where it's going to get a little tricky, and hopefully you'll be able to keep up with it. A man by the name of Chad Hansen comes forward and tells investigators that Billy had been murdered and he knew where the body was. He claimed that a man named Sean Karpiuk had beaten Billy to death, and this Hansen guy had helped him bury the remains, which were wrapped inside of a carpet. The other guy, Karpiuk, had died of a heroin overdose in 2005. So Hansen's tips resulted in authorities searching locations in Seymour, Connecticut in 2008, in Naugatuck State Forest in 2010, and in Oxford, Connecticut in 2011, where they were looking for Billy's body. The Oxford search alone lasted 10 days and cost more than $100,000. In 2011, Hansen was charged with interfering with police and making a false statement. Authorities believed that he had deliberately lied to them in order to mislead the investigation. The charges could have resulted in a sentence of 7 years in prison, but in January of 2013, Hansen pleaded guilty to one charge of making a false statement concerning injury or death and was sentenced to 4.5 years. He had 12 prior criminal convictions before this one. So both Hansen and Karpiuk are considered persons of interest in Billy's disappearance. Witnesses told police that Hansen had actually bragged about killing Billy with Karpiuk and said that his body would never be found. Hansen, who was a habitual drug user, was usually under the influence of heroin or crack at the time that he would make these allegations and these statements. So Hansen maintained his innocence in Billy's disappearance, though. So okay, so where's the connection here? Karpiuk was the son of Madeline Gleason, and Gleason is Billy's former girlfriend. Gleason and Billy had dated for about a year and broke up shortly before he disappeared because Billy thought that she was seeing another man. Billy was at Gleason's residence early in the morning, the day of his disappearance. And Gleason said that he seemed a little depressed when he left. Karpiuk was dating a man by the name of Chris Sorensen, who lived in Woodbridge, Connecticut. Sorensen told police that Billy had called him that day, the day of his disappearance, and told him to quote unquote watch your back at all times. In fact, the last three phone calls that Billy made were to Sorensen. After Billy's disappearance, Gleason, his former girlfriend, sued Billy's relatives, claiming that they had harassed her and falsely accused her of being involved in Billy's case. A judge decided in Gleason's favor and awarded her $52,000 in damages, but the verdict was under appeal. I don't know if it has been resolved since. Billy's mother believes that Hansen may, in fact, be telling the truth about her son's alleged murder and him helping dispose of the body. And she thinks that Hansen's only lying about the actual location of her son's remains. So Billy's family fears for his safety, because of course, initially they thought that, or authorities thought that Billy left on his own, but it has since changed, of course, to a suspected foul play case. Now, Billy enjoyed fishing, hunting, horseback riding, demolition derbies, and snowmobiling. He studied auto mechanics at a community college for a year and had considered a career in law enforcement. He also, or his family says that he rarely traveled anywhere, and it was uncharacteristic of him to leave without warning. So him disappearing, of course, was abnormal. So Billy's case actually is still unsolved. His remains have never been found, despite the over $100,000 excavations, apparently. So, if you know anything about his disappearance or where he may be, or if you have seen anyone matching Billy's description, or if you think you can make the connection between Billy and Chad Hansen or Sean Karpiuk, you can contact the Waterbury Police Department and provide them with any information that you may have, and hopefully William Paul Smolenski Jr.'s case can be solved really soon. Okay, so our last case this week is probably our shortest case this week, but it was so interesting that I felt like I had to include it. So this is case number MP3420 in Namus, the disappearance of Jose Ortiz. Jose is a Hispanic male with brown hair and brown eyes. I don't have a date of birth, but he was 19 at the time of his disappearance in 2005. He stood at 5'10" and weighed 140 pounds. He was last seen wearing a black hooded sweatshirt, a bandana, and blue jeans. And Jose goes by the nickname of Bin Laden from time to time. So, here's the very few details that I have in his case. Jose was last seen in New Haven, Connecticut on December 28th of 2005. He was riding his bicycle at the time of his disappearance. He has never been heard from again, and he wasn't reported missing until January 1st. So the day of Jose's disappearance, a firefighter reported seeing a young man being abducted near the intersection of Poplar Street and Lombard Street near the firehouse. The man was riding a bicycle, which was later positively identified as Jose's, and three men in a silver 1990s model Ford Taurus pulled him off of the bicycle and into the vehicle. Now, of course, investigators believe that the man that was on the bicycle was Jose, and that he was abducted by or kidnapped by these three people in this Taurus. So the kidnapped suspects are only described as being approximately 15 to 21 years of age. At the time of his disappearance, Jose lived with his mother in the 400 block of Lombard Street, which was near the abduction site and, of course, near the firehouse. Authorities believe that Jose was involved in drug activities at the time of his disappearance, but his family doesn't think that he was. They stated that he lived quietly and he actually had dreams of becoming a police officer. So that's all that you really get from the Charlie Project profile, but I did some digging and found some articles, and I got a little bit more information. Not a whole lot. Basically, all you'll find is this information in a more stretched out form. Oh, I'm sorry. I did read that in early February of 2006, police searched the area of the Valley Service Road in North Haven with the aid of cadaver dogs and helicopters because an anonymous tip was received that Jose had been killed and dumped off the highway in a wooded area near New Haven. Now, detectives searched many abandoned properties and desolate areas for any evidence in that area, but I couldn't find any indication of if they actually found anything in that location. The other really cool thing that I found out about Jose's case is that he was actually featured in a cold case prison playing card deck as the Ten of Hearts, or his case was rather featured in a cold case prison playing card deck. But I don't believe that a whole lot of tips were received from this, from him being featured in this deck of cards. As far as I could find out, they only ha actually received one tip, and it wasn't any new information. So there is nothing else on Jose's case. And I wish that there was more information on his case, because it certainly seems so odd to me that he was abducted in the middle of the day, or he was abducted, period, in the middle of an intersection where he could be seen. They did ask if anything was retrieved from the bicycle, because apparently they did end up recovering the bicycle, but I don't they didn't find any fingerprints or anything like that, which they wouldn't if these three men just grabbed him and not the bicycle. So there's really nothing here. You have three suspects, a possible vehicle. You don't really have any description other than 15 to 21 years old. In regards to these men, they don't give race, they don't give height, descript nothing. And all they give is a silver Ford Taurus, a 90s model silver Ford Taurus, which could mean a whole multitude of vehicles. So there, I wish that there was something more definite in regards to descriptions or suspects or anything in Jose's case, but there is nothing. And I don't want to believe that this is the case, but I know that it is a whole lot of times that police see a Hispanic male and dig into his life a little bit and maybe determine that he was involved in narcotics, and the effort isn't quite put into the case that should be. Now, I don't want to say police officers aren't doing, or investigators aren't doing their job, because I'd like to think that every case is investigated just the same, but sometimes I do think that when it comes to narcotics, those disappearances or those murders are not investigated as harshly as other cases. But it's also, I understand that also getting information in those kinds of cases is a little more difficult as well. So it's, I don't think it's necessarily always on police officers in those types of cases. But I do wish that Jose's case, there would be some kind of development in Jose's case really soon. So if you know anything about the disappearance of Jose Ortiz, anything about the three men who abducted him, anything about the vehicle that they were in, please contact the New Haven Police Department and provide any and all information that you may have, and get it out, help get it out to the public, and help Jose's disappearance become solved. So that wraps up episode 29. I'm sorry I don't have a scene again for you this week, but I did post that bonus episode. So if you haven't listened to it already, please go back and take a listen to it. It covers a whole bunch of cases and a whole bunch of states. So you get a little bit of everything in that. And it all starts with me researching one little girl's disappearance in Connecticut. So they do have a couple of Connecticut cases. So if you want to hear about a couple more Connecticut cases, please go over to that bonus episode and give it a listen. You'll also hear about some other ones in different states, but they're all interesting just the same. So I appreciate everyone who tunes in every week and gives a listen. I appreciate everyone who has rated and reviewed this podcast on all the platforms up until this point. I appreciate all my listeners so much, and you're the reason that I continue to do this. If you're listening, I'm gonna keep doing this. As difficult as it may be some weeks, as much or as little time as I may have to actually do this, you are the reason that I continue to do it, because I don't wanna let you down, and I don't wanna let the families of these missing people down, and I just wanna help get these names out there as much as I possibly can. So, if you like this podcast, if you like this episode, if you like the whole thing that I do, do me a favor, go like, follow, favorite, rate, and or review this podcast on whatever platform you listen on. If you listen on Stitcher or Apple Podcast or iTunes, if you could, please go rate this podcast with the 5 stars. I'd wholeheartedly appreciate that. You'll have my most love. I know it requires that you leave a review, but that whatever you say in the review is less important than those 5 stars, apparently, to the powers that be. So, if you haven't already done so as well, you can head over to the Facebook page at /NTBSA podcast. On there, you can see when I post new episodes. I also post the pictures of the missing people that I talk about. And you can also send me a message with any case suggestions that you may have from there as well. But if you don't do Facebook and you do email, you can email me with any case suggestions at nevertobeseenagainpodcast@gmail.com. I appreciate hearing from everyone. I love any case suggestions. And if you have a personal connection to the case, I'd love, or any case, I'd love to hear about that. I don't have to feature it on an episode if you don't want me to, but I'd love to hear any connection that you may have to a missing person. Thank you, as always, for listening. Thank you for your continued support. And thank you for tuning in every week to give this podcast a purpose. Because if nobody was listening to this, if not even one person listened to this podcast, it really wouldn't help these missing people be found. So I hope that you tune in once again next week to hear more about those never to be seen again.